Squire nagged and bullied till I went to fight. Under Lord Darby's scheme, I died in hell. They called it Passchendaele. My wound was slight, and I was hobbling back, and then a shell burst slick upon the duckboards. So I fell into the bottomless mud and lost the light. At sermon time, while Squire is in his pew, he gives my gilded name a thoughtful stare. For though low down upon the list, I'm there. In proud and glorious memory, that's my due. 2 bleeding years I fought in France for Squire. I suffered anguish that he's never guessed. Oh, once I came home on leave and then went west. What greater glory could a man desire?
That was a poem written by the famous First World War poet Siegfried Sassoon, a man who became an officer in the British Army. His experiences on the Western Front turned him into a pacifist. And in that poem that he called Memorial Tablet, it's a scathing indictment, really, on what he considered to be the glorification of war. He's talking about the horrors of trench warfare, Passchendaele in particular. And we can clearly see how disillusioned he is, or was, I should say, with war. His tone and his words are very bitter, and he conveys the profound anguish that he must have felt and that he witnessed other people facing as well. And we begin the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, because this week we're going to talk about something that Sassoon mentioned at the beginning of that poem. He said, Squire nagged and bullied till I went to fight under Lord Derby's scheme. It's that scheme that we're going to be talking about, the Derby scheme. In October 1915, a British aristocrat called Lord Derby was appointed as the Director General of Recruiting. And he introduced a system which was really the prelude to full conscription, which has become known in history as the Derby scheme. Kitchener's call for volunteers in 1914 had worked, but now, over a year later, the number of volunteers had dried up. The news coming back from the front was awful. People could see what had happened at Neuve Chapelle and at Loos and at Albers Ridge, and perhaps those that remained at home despite the threat of a white feather, they weren't keen to go. So Lord Derby came up with this scheme, whereas male adults between 18 and 40 years old were asked to either enlist or register for call-up if required, and hundreds of thousands of them did so and were then sent back home until they were required, or mobilised as they called it. They were told that this was probably their last chance to volunteer and therefore have some choice of which unit, battalion or regiment that they were going to be able to fight in. That scheme, that idea was going to come to an end soon. And those that went on the Derby scheme register were classified depending upon age and marital status. There were, of course, exemptions for potential call-up because of people were perhaps employed in protected industries, reserve jobs, they were needed at home. And they thought that they would be able to identify as many as 2 million actual potential recruits, but many of them didn't register and the scheme closed in December of 1915, just a few weeks after it was introduced. The next step was taken and that was conscription. And Fred Frost, from a village called Harpole in Northamptonshire, he was one of those men that did actually volunteer under the Derby scheme. I've got his short service attestation form in front of me. It tells us that his name was Frederick Frost and that he was 23 years old and 7 months when this form was completed, just 4 days before the Derby scheme was closed. It tells us that, as many people were in Northamptonshire, he was working in the shoe industry as a heel maker, and that he was single, he wasn't married. But question 10 says, did you receive a notice, and do you understand its meaning and who gave it to you? And he's answered yes, and the notice was given to him by an officer in the 1st Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment. Question 11 then went on to ask him if he was willing to serve in the British Army for the duration of the war, and he's answered yes. And beneath that, we can see his signature and that of the witness who'd given him the notice to enlist under the Derby scheme. He was then sent home, and it wasn't until February of 1916, so that's nearly three months later, before he received notice that he was to be mobilised. And it's his story that we're going to talk about in this week's podcast. We're going to follow his story to the Somme, where he joins the battle with his new battalion just as that dreadful battle was coming to a muddy and bloody end. He then spends that cold winter of 1916-17 out of the trenches before going back into the line in March 1917. We're going to see what happened to Fred Frost when he took part in an action which was as bloody and nasty and violent as any other of those actions for the people that were involved as the Germans withdrew to the Hindenburg Line. From there, the battalion goes north to the Ypres salient, and Fred, on two dreadful days, was involved in the most horrendous battle of all, what was to become the most horrendous battle of all, considered by, as we know, so many of the men that fought as the worst experience that any British or Commonwealth soldier has ever experienced in warfare. He was there, Fred was there. We'll find out what happened to him there. And that was in the summer of 1917. And his story ends in the March of 1918, during the German spring offensive. His battalion are brought down from Ypres to stem the tide of the German stormtroopers that were charging across the old 1916 Somme battlefield, hoping to split the British and French army in two and win the war before those Americans arrive, to boost the Allies' chances of not just surviving this German onslaught, but hopefully to go on and win the war, which of course is what happened in the end. But that's where Fred's story finishes. Not because he's killed, no. He gets what the soldiers considered to be a blighty wound, a wound that was serious enough to end his experience on the Western Front, but didn't change his life, and meant that he went on to have a full and rewarding life and live to be an old man in that village of Harpole on the west side of Northampton. This is to be his story, a story that's never been told before. But a couple of weeks ago, I took Fred's great-nephew on a pilgrimage. He'd been aware of his story for many, many years, just like many listeners to this podcast have been aware of their own relative stories in exactly the same way. And we travelled to the places that we're going to talk about in the podcast, and we stood there and read accounts of what it was like there and considered what Fred and his comrades went through. And it's that story that I want to share with you this week. Fred, of course, is long gone, but by listening to the podcast, we can ensure that despite the fact that he survived the horrors that we're going to discuss, he wasn't a victim, he was a survivor, as most men were. 88% of them came home, 12% of them approximately died. One of the myths of the Great War is that everybody was killed. Fred wasn't. He received a minor wound, and it was perhaps that minor blighty wound that saved his life. Now, we had a piece of good fortune when I started looking into Fred's story, and people will know that approximately 80% of the World War I service records were destroyed in the Blitz by a German bomb in 1940. But Fred's records were one of those that thankfully did survive. A number of the documents, you can see, have been burnt around the edges, but they've been digitised and they're on websites that require you to pay an annual subscription to access them. Find My Past and Ancestry. But I've got subscriptions to both of those websites, And I'm looking at his service record now. I mentioned earlier his attestation form. And the next document in the file tells us that he was 5'8.5", quite tall for a man at that time. And having been mobilised in February of 1916, he would have gone away to do his basic training. But he then found time to return home and marry his sweetheart, Irene Threadgold. And they were married at the parish church in a nearby village of Brinkton on the 22nd of May 1916. And it wasn't until the last day of October of 1916 that Freda completed his training and was shipped off to France, by which time that great push, the Battle of the Somme, had been raging in northern France for four full months, and it was now entering those awful final stages. Now, of course, when he joined the army, he would have been a private soldier, but by this time he'd received his first promotion and was a lance corporal, so his leadership abilities must have been spotted very early in his training, because he was a lance corporal by the time he got married. And the next form in the file tells us that he was initially posted to the 1st Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment, but as soon as he arrived in France, was transferred to the 2nd Battalion, another regular battalion of professional soldiers. But by this time, many of those original men that had gone out to France in August and September of 1914 had become casualties, and it was a regular battalion in name only. And the file tells us that not only was he in the 2nd Battalion of the Northamptonshires, but unusually it lists which company was in. It tells us that he was in C Company. There were four companies, A, B, C and D. He was in C. And we also know that that first promotion to Lance Corporal came on the 9th of May 1916. So that's a couple of weeks before he got married. And so off he went to the Somme, and that's what we did. We went out to the same battlefield, and using the battalion diary, we went to the very place where Fred first experienced the horrors of the Great War. Just going back to his service record in the file, and it tells us that he served on the Western Front for 1 year and 151 days. So that's from the 1st of November 1916, and his last day on the battlefield was on the 31st of March 1918. It's about 18 months. So as we talked about before, by early November of 1916, when Fred arrived out there, the battle had ground into a muddy stalemate. The dreadful weather had turned the battlefield into a muddy quagmire, and any hope of victory by this stage had evaporated. It was a question, really, of holding what they'd gained. And as I say, we have to turn to the battalion diary to give us some idea of what happened in those first few days that Fred experienced. Battalion diary, written by an officer, sometimes in great detail, sometimes not. Battalion diary of the 2nd North Ants was written by different officers throughout the war, I suppose, as some became casualties or were transferred to other battalions. And sometimes it's easy to read their handwriting, sometimes it's typed up. For the period of early November, it's quite well written. The handwriting is quite neat. And the places that we need to identify had been written quite conveniently in capital letters. Now, obviously, being written so long ago, these battalion diaries can be quite difficult to read. And if you can read them, they can be difficult to understand unless you've got some knowledge of these places on the Western Front. But you can access them free of charge, because they've all been digitised by the National Archives. And if you go onto their website, set up an account, you can download them and read them at your own leisure. It really does help put together the story of individual units. It's very rare that individual soldiers, especially other ranks or NCOs, non-commissioned officers, are mentioned, but quite often, if you're following the story of an officer, he'll be mentioned if he's been wounded. Sometimes there's lists of awards, gallantry awards, and very often, of course, they get mentioned if they're killed. So back to Fred, and there we have this man, newly married. By this time, he's 24 years old. He's come out of a boot and shoe factory in Northamptonshire. He finds himself in an area called the Le Transloy Ridges, near to a village called Leboeuf, not far from the main D929 road that, as visitors to the Somme will know, goes from Albert to Bapaume. As you drive towards Bapaume, it's on the right-hand side. There's nothing there now, just fields. Nothing whatsoever to indicate what was going on there in 1916. The diary tells us that on the 5th of November, so 3 days after Fred had arrived, the battalion moved towards what was then the front line, and they went through the ruined village of Montauban, which had famously been taken on the first day of the Battle of the Somme 4 months earlier. They billeted in bivouacs, which were basically tents. And the diary says that the men were quite comfortable despite the wind and the weather. At 4 p.m. on the 6th of November, they moved into frontline trenches near Leboeuf on those ridges. It rained heavily and it was very stormy too. Just getting up to those frontline positions could have been no easy task. If you look at photographs of the Somme battlefield in November 1916, you see that thick, glutinous mud. The chalk just below the surface mingled in with that mud. Men, horses, limbers, finding it almost impossible to move equipment up to the front line or to get casualties back. It must have been, on top of being freezing cold, absolutely exhausting. And when it comes to trenches, well, they weren't trenches as we imagined them. They were really just shell holes linked together. But the battalion found somewhere to call their front line. It was a series of trenches that would have been dug by the Germans in what was their reserve positions. And on a trench map, they were known as Dewdrop Trench and Rainy Trench, which is quite appropriate, really. And a few hundred yards away, Antelope Trench. They were their positions. But what they didn't know was where the German positions were. Because the Germans had withdrawn a few days earlier after heavy fighting, and they weren't, as they'd been earlier in the war, on top of a ridge. They were on the other side of the ridge, so they couldn't be seen. And it meant, apart from the fact that they couldn't be observed, that if the British were to attack them, they would have to cross that ridge. They'd be silhouetted against the horizon. And although the Germans were lower down, it would give them an advantage. Now, they spent just 2 days in the trenches at that time, during which they were shelled by their unseen German artillery. They were also sniped at by the enemy, who'd taken up positions in shell holes in front of their own trenches. Battalion diary tells us the battalion was shelled fairly heavily on German Trench and Antelope Trench. Our snipers, during the course of the day, put an end to the enemy's persistent sniping, which was coming from Sleet Trench and the gun pits. 5 men were killed during this spell in the trenches during over those 2 days. 4 of them are still missing and are remembered on the Tietvale Memorial to the missing. But just a short distance away is the AIF burial grounds near the village of Fleur, and the only man that has a grave that was killed during that spell in the trenches is 2nd Lieutenant Leonard Rawlings, who was just 19 years old. But he wasn't from Northampton, he wasn't even from England. He was from Sydney in New South Wales. And we went to see his grave before we left the battlefield and discovered that he was born in July of 1897, the younger of 2 children and the only son, and his father was a colonial merchant. And shortly after his 13th birthday in 1910, he was sent to England to carry out his academic studies. And then after that, he went to a boarding school in Roubaix in France to continue his studies. And when war broke out, he was still at that college in Roubaix. And he went to England at once. And in that October, despite only being 17, he enlisted in the Inns of Court Officer Training Corps. After several months, He was gazetted to a commission in the North Ants. That was in February of 1915. And in May 1916, he joined the 2nd Battalion, Fred's Battalion, and went over the top for the first time and spent 6 months on the Somme. On that date, on the 7th of November, he was serving in a frontline trench when a German shell struck, killing both Leonard and his commanding officer. He was originally buried close to where he fell on the battlefield, but as with so many of them, when the battlefield was searched after the war, his body was exhumed and what they call concentrated or reburied in its present location in the AIF burial ground. So now Fred knows what it's like. He can see the rain falling, he can feel the cold, even though they're in camps behind the lines. And they know at some stage they'd be going back up to the line again. And it wasn't long before that happened, because it was the 16th of November when they found themselves in the same trenches as they'd been in 8 or 9 days before. The 16th of November 1916. And it was a Sunday morning when we stood in exactly the same location where Fred had been 109 years ago. And as I read from the battalion diary, I mentioned the date, the 16th of November. And then Fred's relative, Tim, who was with us, of course, said that's today. It was the exact day. We were standing in the same place that his great uncle had stood at all those years before. That was a coincidence. I hadn't planned that. Five more men died on that day. They still didn't know where the German trenches were located, so a patrol was sent out to find out. But as they crossed the crest of the ridge, just as the Germans had planned, they opened fire on them. Of course, the Germans then gave away their position. The survivors of that patrol went back, and it meant that they could set up their own positions. And the men were tasked with digging a trench in that muddy ground, 250 yards long, linking one position with another. They were there not to fight. They were there to dig. The following day, on the 17th of November, the battalion was relieved, having completed their objective. The officer in the battalion diary has written, "It was the worst relief I have yet met." And he was talking about the awful conditions. They went back to Milt, to their billets there, several miles away. They said it was a very cold and miserable night. The next day was a Sunday. It was a voluntary church service. The men rested, and a draft of new men arrived to replace those that the battalion had lost. So we stood on that very position on the same day that Fred was there. We photograph the battlefield, which of course is now quiet. The only thing that's noticeable now is not German trenches on the other side of that ridge, but those large windmills generating electricity. We found a farm track. We followed that farm track using the digital trench system Linesman. We could see exactly what happened when that patrol of men reached the crest of that ridge. From their starting positions, the crest doesn't look very steep, but when you walk up it, it is steep. And you look down to where the German trenches were, you look down to where those machine guns were, and you realise how exposed their positions were, what an advantage the Germans had had with these new tactics that they'd tailored as we now entered the fifth month of the Battle of the Somme. That was their only experience of that battle. The battalion was withdrawn approximately 30 miles behind the lines, and that's where they spent that dreadful winter. For example, December was spent marching, training and practicing. They were given Christmas Day off. Battalion diary says there were no parades. That's all it says on Christmas Day. In the new year, January 1917, they found themselves opposite the Germans, just holding the line. Things were very quiet. There were no deaths at all reported during this period. What they didn't know was that opposite them, the Germans were not being quiet, not really. They were being very busy, because several miles away to the east, they were digging what was to become known to the British as the Hindenburg Line. And in March of 1917, the Germans made that strategic withdrawal from the Somme. This was to shorten their line. This was mean that they could build much more deeper, stronger defensive positions with hundreds of yards of barbed wire, much thicker. Deep defensive positions once again dug into the chalk. And this was to come as a surprise to the British, of course, when they realised that the Germans opposite them had vacated their trenches and had made this withdrawal. But of course, the British then had to follow them. The Germans, as they withdrew, carried out that scorched earth policy and rendered the whole area that they were giving up uninhabitable and made it impossible for the British and the Australians and the French and the Canadians to occupy. They cut down all the trees, they poisoned the wells, and as we'll see, they smashed to pieces the villages that for 2.5 years had been in German possession. They were now of no use, these villages, to the Germans. So they destroyed them. And that meant they could be of little of no use to the British and their allies. And it was during this fighting retreat that Fred and the 2nd Northants were to attack those withdrawing Germans on a ridge overlooking a village called Moislain. Now, what happened on that day, I couldn't find any details of in any of the history books. So once again, I turned to the battalion diary. It's the 4th of March, 1917. The Germans have dug in temporary trenches on a ridge overlooking that village of Moislain. The British, of course, were opposite them a few hundred yards away, lower down in the valley. The German frontline trenches were known firstly as Palace Trench and then Fritsch Trench. The Northants were given orders to take those first two German lines on top of that ridge. And that's exactly what they did. And we don't know exactly what happened up there, but the fighting must have been ferocious. And that's where we went. We drove along a country road, which at first was metalled and then turned into a farm track. We went up there and we stood on the location that was marked on our trench maps as Palace Trench. We read from the battalion diary. It says the battalion attacked the enemy trenches on the ridge. All the objectives given to the battalion were taken and held against repeated counterattacks. The casualties were 7 officers and 235 other ranks. It then lists the officers that were with the battalion that day. Fred was with them. And as we stood there, we notice stuff beneath our feet. Now, when you go to the 1916 battlefields of the Somme or the 1917 battlefields of Ypres, you can often find evidence of the fighting that took place beneath your feet. Bits of shrapnel, shrapnel balls, occasionally bits of bullets. But here, at 4th of March 1917, was the only day that either side attacked until 1918, when the Germans swept through here during their spring advance, the spring offensive. But surprisingly, we found lots of evidence of the fighting that took place there. Most of it was shells. There was a couple of hand grenades there. The shells hadn't been piled up by a farmer and placed on the side of the road awaiting collection by the authorities. They were still in situ. They were beneath the long, wet grass. Fred was there that day. We know he was there because the following day, the battalion diary tells us that he was awarded the Military Medal. And he was also promoted from Lance Corporal to Sergeant. Casualties, as we know, were heavy. It was eventually established that 66 of the Northants men died in that attack. 38 of them are still missing and remembered on the Tietvaal Memorial, which is some way away. But 26 of them were buried in the Finns New British Cemetery. And that was to be our next stop, to go and see the graves of some of those men that Fred would have known. The first one we came to in Finn's Cemetery was a Lance Corporal F. Slater. He was 28 years old and his widowed mum had placed a notice in the newspaper to say that he'd been killed that day. And she said the Lord saw him do his best and he's taken him home to eternal rest. And then a few steps away was the grave of Private Roland Alfred Archer, another man who died that day. He was from Rushton in Northamptonshire. On his headstone, the family inscription said, "Safe in thy keeping." And in the local newspaper, I found an article that told us a little bit about Roland. It said an officer's devotion to a dying soldier, a touching instance of the sympathetic bond of brotherhood existing between British officers and men on the battlefield, is contained in a letter to this journal from the 2nd Lieutenant Scholler of the Steelbacks. The letter is the outcome of a visit to the Independent office, Independent being the name of the local newspaper, by Mr. and Mrs. Archer, who lost their eldest son, Lance Corporal Archer, in action a few months ago, and have just suffered the loss of their only other boy, who was killed on the 4th of March. The heartbroken parents, bereft of both of their boys, anxiously appealed for particulars of their second boy's death, the only information being in their possession being the formal notification from the War Office. Within 10 days, the Independent had obtained the desired information through the medium of the following letter from Lieutenant Scholler. And Scholler wrote to the paper, he said, "I'm very sorry to hear that his people have heard nothing about him. The reason being that his platoon commander was wounded before him. I was in command of the platoon next to him and happened to be near him when he was hit through the chest and never recovered consciousness. I stayed with him until he died, which was about 5 minutes, for he was too badly hit to be in any pain. I told him to cheer up and that he would be going home, but apparently he did not understand and died almost at once. He was reverently buried on the battlefield. I'm very sorry indeed for his relatives. He died doing his duty in a very important and successful fight." As I said, Battalion Diary then lists the name of several soldiers that were decorated for their bravery on that day. The battalion's commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Buckle, he'd already been awarded the Military Cross, but that day he was decorated with the DSO, the Distinguished Service Order. And then we've got three more officers that were awarded the Military Cross. One of them, 2nd Lieutenant Oldfield, received a bar, the second Military Cross, and we're going to meet up with him later on. Battalion Diary then goes on to list six NCOs, or private soldiers, that are awarded the Military Medal, and there is Sergeant 22971 F.J. Frost, our man. The local newspaper back home tells us that for gallant conduct on March the 4th, Lance Corporal Frost has been awarded the Military Medal and promoted to Sergeant and offered a commission that he decided not to take up. He says he's the second son of Private Solomon Frost, who's now on duty at Eastcote Camp. Now, that was a German prisoner of war camp in Northamptonshire, and he also says he's got a brother serving with the Middlesex Regiment. He enlisted in February 1916, went to France in the following November, and that Mrs. Frost, his wife, has two brothers that are serving. And thankfully, I've checked it out, and both of those two lads did come home, as of course did Fred. Now, the 2nd Battalion of the Northamptonshires, they were part of the 8th Division within the 4th Army. Now, it's not often that I talk about the structures of the army, and the only reason I'm doing it now is because in the battalion diary, there's a message from Rawlinson, one of the high-ranking generals. And it turns out that the 8th Division is leaving the 4th Army at this stage, and he writes a congratulatory message. And in it he says, desires to express to all ranks my appreciation of the good services they've rendered during the last 7 months. And he mentions the attack on that day, the 4th of March. It says the capture of Palace and Fritsch trenches in March 1917 were operations requiring careful preparation and bold leadership, and the success attained deserves high praise. He says, "I regret that the division is leaving the 4th Army, but I hope that on some future occasion I may again have the good fortune to find them under my command." We followed their journey down into the village of Moyslanes, which the battalion was then based in between March 1917 and May 1917. But this large village or small town, I don't know which one it is, as I said earlier, had been completely destroyed by the Germans as they withdrew. I've got some photographs as it looked after that destruction. And I've got another photograph showing how it looked, that village, in the 1920s or 1930s when the villagers had returned. And we managed to line those positions up and took a photograph of it when we were there a couple of weeks ago. Now, the battalion then moved up to Ypres, the Ypres salient, in readiness for that third battle of Ypres, Passchendaele. Before the battle began, they spent some time in and around the trenches opposite Railway Wood. And when they were out of the line, they were in billets in the ruined city of Ypres. And on the first day of the battle, the 31st of July 1917, the battalion was involved in the success of that first day. And they were to attack diagonally across the Menin Road near Hoog through the destroyed German trenches that had been obliterated during a two-week bombardment. And then they were to take and hold positions to the north of the Menin Road, just east of Chateau Wood, which is still there. The positions that they ended up in were basically in, if you know that area, in the car park of the amusement park that is now on that ground where this fighting took place. And that's where we went next. First thing we did, as you must do when you go to the Menin Road, is stop for a refreshment break at the Hoog Crater Cafe, where Nick and his staff welcomed us, a hot drink and a snack. And as we sat there, we contemplated what was going on that day, 31st of July 1917, just to the back of the cafe. That's the route that the 2nd North Ants were taking. And we got a neatly typed up report in the battalion diary, which I'm going to share with you now. It says, on the evening of July the 30th, the battalion was occupying Ritz dugouts. At 9 p.m. it moved in the order of DACB companies to its assembly trenches, known as Kingsway and Kingsway Support. Artillery on both sides were very active, particularly our own, and considerable difficulty was experienced owing to the muddy and damaged state of the communication trenches. The night was dark and cloudy, and it being inclined to rain. Battalion headquarters moved to a big dugout under the Menin Road at the Burr Crossroads. And that's where there is one of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries located, at what was marked on the maps as the Burr Crossroads. The concentration and forming up were complete by midnight. On our right, we were in touch with the 1st Worcestershires, on our left with the 2nd West Yorkshires. We formed the left battalion of the 24th Infantry Brigade, whose headquarters were at Halfway House. And then it documents the map references of the objectives of the battalion for the following morning. And of course, armed with our trench maps in Linesman, we were able to identify exactly where those positions were. On the night of the 29th to the 30th of July, the enemy had sent out patrols to ascertain whether Kingsway was occupied. To prevent him getting to know of our assembly for the attack, A&D companies sent out energetic and active patrols, which effectively prevented the enemy from leaving his front line. Thus, he had not the slightest inkling of our pending attack. Throughout the night, the enemy was inactive. His artillery was less aggressive than usual. 0 hour was at 3:50 a.m. The barrage came down with a tremendous roar, and the battalion, lying on the parapets of Kingsway and Kingsway Support, advanced under its cover. Perfect order prevailed, the battalion keeping its formations as if on picture trenches back at Boney. That's where they did their training. Almost at the start, Lieutenant Metcalf and 2nd Lieutenant Fisher were wounded, possibly by one of our own shells. Now, this is because they're following this creeping barrage that had been introduced in the previous year on the Somme, when, of course, they knew if they got close to this creeping barrage, which would lift 50, 100 yards in front of them, there was a chance that some of the officers and men would be casualties. But they'd worked out that without this creeping barrage, if they used the previous systems, lifting their fire from the German trenches, the casualties would be a lot worse. The first wave passed on right over the German front line and halted in its objective, Ignis Trench, and ignorant support. The second line halted in its objective, which was the German front line. Little resistance was encountered from the enemy. He was too dazed to put up a fight. The mopping up of the enemy's front and support trenches was done quickly and well. Number 4 platoon cleaned the German front line and the system of trenches in the rear of it. Sergeant Southgate, with one section, drove a machine gun and crew into the hands of the 2nd West Yorkshire Regiment. Number 15 platoon mopped up the crater on the Hoog Road. That crater, of course, is still there. And the buildings along the Menin Road and defended the crater. Number 5 platoon cleared the Hoog Chateau, the stables and Ignis support and the minor organisations around it. In all, about 60 prisoners were taken in these areas. Meanwhile, the 3rd and 4th waves pushed forward. Captain Collier Ferguson, finding his company held up by a machine gun in a wide strong point, rushed it with 10 men. He encountered a German post of about 50 men shooting down the Worcesters. With great dash, he rushed it and with his men killed an officer and 14 men. Others were blown up in two large concrete shelters. One shelter apparently contained a large supply of bombs and very lights. For a bomb thrown into it and caused a large explosion and fire, which accounted for 8 or 9 of the enemy. Now, Collier Ferguson was subsequently awarded the Victoria Cross for his actions that day. He doesn't know it, because having just completed that successful attack on that German position, he went back to headquarters. He was given information to his commanding officer when he was shot by a sniper and killed. He's buried in the Menin Road South Cemetery, and his Victoria Cross is held in a museum here in Northampton. Battalion diary goes on to tell us that Jacob Trench was taken before 5:30 a.m. and mopped up. Number 12 platoon mopped up Chateau Wood and the dugouts in James Trench. Soon after the capture of Jacob Trench, the commanding officer and adjutant arrived in the objective. Communication by wire was at once established with the brigade. B and C companies, C of course, by this time Sergeant Fred Frost is amongst them, then pushed out between 100 and 200 yards in front of Jacob Trench. A line of posts was at once dug, and that was the point when Collier Ferguson was killed by that sniper. It says a bullet hit him in the head and death was instantaneous. He had done magnificently. The capture of Jacob Trench was largely due to his courage and initiative. A company, forming up in Chateau Wood, suffered rather severely from a machine gun barrage and from shelling. Having been informed by the brigade that the enemy were massing for a counter-attack on our right front, the commanding officer, about 10 a.m, ordered A company right up into the blue line, and two strong points were dug between our right and the Worcesters' left. So we often talk about, don't we, the slaughter and the waste of that Battle of Passchendaele, the Third Battle of Ypres. But this is the first day. It started to rain that day about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then the tragedy began. But before that, as we see here, most of the battalions achieved everything that they were asked to do so. But of course there was a cost. Battalion diary tells us one officer was killed, that being Collier Ferguson, 2 wounded. 113 other ranks were wounded, 7 other ranks killed, and 35 more were missing. And even before they went over the top, 74 other ranks had become casualties. It was eventually established that 24 of them had been killed that day. They went out of the line, and they returned just over 2 weeks later for the second stage of the battle, known in the history books as the Battle of Langemarck. The North Ants, this time, were not far away from where they'd left the battle. The 31st of July, they were on the West Oak Ridge. Before we go to that, let's just look at an account from someone that was there on the 31st of July. Lieutenant Colonel A.C. Johnston was commanding the 10th Battalion of the Cheshires. And in Nigel Steele and Peter Hart's book, Passchendaele, The Sacrificial Ground, he tells us that his unit was relieving the 2nd North Ants. But he was not going to help us much as they were holding new half-dug trenches, which the rain was filling fast or making them crumble to nothing. The relief was quickly over, and I made my HQ in a German concrete machine gun emplacement on the Belvedere Ridge. The rain continued to pour, and there was a good deal of shelling. About midday, the Germans started to bombard us heavily and kept it up for the rest of the day. We had an awful time. There was no cover for the men. Trenches were soon non-existent or became wet ditches, in which men often sunk up to their waists, and it took six men to pull one man out of the mud. The Germans had got the range to an inch, had direct observation of us from our right, and plastered the area incessantly with crumps, whiz-bangs and 4.2s. Our casualties mounted rapidly. There was no cover. All one could do was to spread the men out in crump holes to minimise casualties. So, just like Fred did, we made our way up onto the West Oak Ridge, very close to the village of West Oak. Again, just to the north of the Menin Road, Battalion Diary tells us what happened there. All went well at first with the 23rd and 25th Infantry Brigades. By 7 a.m, they'd gained all their objectives after stiff fighting. At least 300 prisoners were taken and passed to our lives. Those captured by the infantry brigade were handed over to the regimental sergeant major at the Belvedere Farm. Owing to the failure of the division on the left and the division on the right to make good their advance, the two attacking brigades were compelled to withdraw. In consequence of this, at about 10:30 a.m, the commanding officer, S.G. Latham, Military Cross, moved C&D companies to Jaffa Trench at between the West Oak Crossroads and J7B77, that's a map reference. And that's where we were standing as I was reading this account to Fred's relatives. Few casualties were sustained in this movement. These two companies remained in these trenches until about 4 p.m. About noon, the situation was as follows, then describes where each of the companies were. Immediately, a very heavy enemy barrage was put down on the West Oak Ridge on these two companies. He then personally ordered the companies to go forward 150 yards to a line marked by tape. These two companies forced their way through the enemy barrage and, in spite of heavy shell and machine gun fire, drove the enemy back with the bayonet. Almost at the commencement of this barrage, Captain Blake was wounded through the neck and had to withdraw. We drove back the enemy, and along with the remnants of the Irish Rifles and the Royal Barks, the Rifle Brigade and the Lynx established a new front line. C&D companies went forward with little loss. The remarkable courage and coolness of Brigadier General Coffin undoubtedly had a very high moral effect on all the troops in the neighbourhood, despite the heavy bombardment and dangerous situation. The commanding officer went forward with Captain Oldfield, MC. Now remember, Captain Oldfield, who was the man that was awarded the Military Cross for his actions on the 4th of March earlier that year on the Moyslands Ridge, that was his second Military Cross. He went forward with his commanding officer to survey the position before he'd gone many yards ahead of Jaffa Trench, where we were now standing. Oldfield was hit right through the heart by a sniper's bullet. The loss of this very gallant officer, who'd served continuously with the battalion since November 1914 and risen from Lance Corporal to the position of Company Commander, was a very severe blow to the battalion. He'd taken part in the battles of Neuve Chapelle, Aubers Ridge, Thiepval and the Moylands Ridge. He was awarded the Military Cross in January 1917 and gained a bar to it in March. He was buried after nightfall on the West Oak Ridge. And as we left the battlefield and went back to our car, we thought of that man. 27-year-old John Burley Oldfield came from Wimbledon, an unmarried man. Perhaps he's still buried there where we were walking, because they said he was buried, but he doesn't have a grave. His grave was lost. He's remembered on the Tynecott Memorial. The account continued. About 9 o'clock, the enemy attempted another counterattack, and this was driven off with ease. Large numbers were caught by our barrage in the marshes of the Hanabeek and killed. As it was getting dark at 9:30, the battalion took over another line. The night passed quietly. The artillery during the following day was not so active as usual, but good sniping was carried out on the enemy positions east of the Hainbeek. At night, posts were pushed forward and active patrolling was carried out, which prevented the enemy from again crossing the stream. The night of the 17th and the 18th was also quiet. On the night of the 19th and the 20th, the battalion was relieved by two companies of the London Regiment, the 18th London Regiment, and withdrew to Halifax Camp. Casualties on that day, 34 other ranks killed, 22 wounded, 3 other ranks missing. They only had 13 officers and 400 other ranks when they went into action that day. They ended back where they began. They hadn't achieved their objectives that day, no fault of their own. The Commonwealth War Graves Commission website tells us that 41 of them died that day. 37 of them have no known grave, and like Captain Oldfield are remembered on the Tynecott Memorial. And as we stood in that position, we could look back, and in the distance, the fading light of the late afternoon, we could see the Cloth Hall, and next to it, the spire of St. Martin's Cathedral. And we could see why, for 3 years, the Germans had a clear view of the city. And that's one of the reasons why that city was wiped from the face of the earth. And that was the battalion's last involvement in the Battle of Passchendaele. Fred, no doubt thinking of his wife back home, there's no evidence in the file that he went back on leave. He'd been thinking about Irene and his parents back home. And in March of 1918, after months of preparation, 21st of March, 4:35 a.m., after a 5-hour German bombardment, over they came, the great German offensive of the spring of 1918, Kaiser's offensive. They break through the British lines in Operation Michael. And the Northamptonshires were sent down from Ypres to try and hold the line on the third day of the German advance. They were exhausted after a 17-mile march onto the battlefield. They were driven back across the old Somme battlefields. The diary tells us every available man, including clerks and cooks at brigade headquarters, were used to stem the tide. So we followed their journey. Of course we did. We joined the battalion at a place called Eppencourt. They were told to take up positions on the west side of a canal bank. We stood on that canal bank. On the other side of the bank are some trees, and then there's the natural river. Battalion diary tells us that the whole brigade retired in good order. The right flank was in danger and managed to hold off the German advance long enough for neighbouring units to withdraw, and then they made their withdrawal as well as the Germans managed to get across the river and the canal. On the 25th of March, the diary tells us that they formed a defensive flank, but it was unavoidable that a large gap should exist between C and D Company. The 4th Yorks was put into this gap, but it was really too late to affect the situation. The enemy made a determined attack on our right, causing us to withdraw a considerable distance. A Company held their position till surrounded and had to fight their way back. They nevertheless held till an orderly retirement could be effected. The whole rearguard action at very close quarters offered the enemy a very stubborn resistance and enabled the whole line to withdraw to the railway embankment. Later, about 9:30, the entire garrison of the railway had to withdraw to a line in front of Agincourt. And the story goes on as they withdrew about 17 miles. And on the following day, the 26th of March at 11 a.m, the order was given to retire to a line to defend the small village of Rosières. This retirement was affected by artillery formation of platoons. The whole night was occupied in hand digging in and wiring as far as material permitted. So because this area hadn't been fought over before, it was way behind the British line for over 3 years. There were no trenches there, there were no defensive positions, there were no bunkers, there was nothing. It was a question of getting your entrenching shovel out and digging as fast as you could. The following morning, the enemy attacked on our right, driving back the 8th Durham Light Infantry exposing our flank. At this period, 2nd Lieutenant McGregor, Sergeant Goosey and Sergeant Tibble organised a small party and counterattacks, thus re-establishing our line and driving back the enemy beyond his original position. But the next day, the Germans attacked again. The enemy, it says, launched an overwhelming attack on our left, causing a complicated withdrawal and a change of direction to a new position near K. The enemy advanced very rapidly on us, having covered the retirement of the 23rd Brigade and practically surrounding the high ground we'd retired on. In order to occupy the high ground, it was necessary to go through a heavy machine gun barrage. The CO, Lieutenant Colonel Latham, himself organised the battalion in the valley and had them in extending order in position, only sustaining two wounded in doing so. At 5 p.m, we withdrew and marched to Junel through Moriel. At Junel, the CO personally had to billet the battalion. This was finished about 3 a.m. after a whole day's hard fighting, and the battalion had marched 16 miles during that retirement. And it was at some stage during this attack by the Germans that Fred was wounded and evacuated back to the UK. 71 of his mates weren't so lucky. They died during that retreat. Most of them are still missing. They're remembered on the Poisier Memorial to the missing. But what was his injury? His service record tells us that he suffered a gunshot wound to his right hand. He went back to the UK and was treated in a military hospital in Tooting in South London. His wound, thankfully for him, was serious enough that he was never called on to go back to the Western Front. He was discharged in June of 1919. There was a bit of irony for him. We can tell this probably irritated him a bit, because when the army sent to him his service medals, on the document that they sent it with, they described him as a private. And this was in 1921, and he quickly sent a letter back to the War Office. It said, "Having received my medals from records, I'm returning them as the rank is incorrectly stated. Will you please rectify the mistake and return the medals to me?" They called him a private, as of course we know he was a sergeant. The War Office did exactly what he asked. In a letter dated the 11th of October 1921, they say that the medal rolls in possession of this office have been amended accordingly, and the error is much regretted. Fred was awarded a war pension in 1919, and a medical report tells us that he'd suffered a 30% disability, and that it was expected that his wound would heal within 12 months. In 1921, Fred and Irene were still living in Harpole. Fred was working at another shoe factory in Northampton. In 1939, I can find them on the register, still living in Harpole, still working in the shoe trade. And Fred lived until 1982, when he died at the age of 89, 9th of January 1982, still living in Harpole, where he'd lived all his life. There are so many Frosts that live in that village. That's not an extraordinary story that I've just told you. It's a typical story of a man that didn't volunteer initially, but knowing the call was coming, he enlisted under that Derby scheme, but not before he'd married his sweetheart, and thankfully he returned home and lived the rest of his long life with Irene. And his great-nephew Tim, he knew him. Tim's mum is in her late 80s, and she knew the story. And she was very keen that Tim was to visit the battlefield just as we'd done and come home and tell her what he'd discovered. And hopefully the story will be remembered in the Frost family for decades, maybe hundreds of years to come. Maybe someone will listen to this podcast in the years to come after we're all gone. But even if they don't listen to this podcast, there's a 50-page document that I wrote up containing all of the records that I've quoted today, the witness accounts, the photographs that we took on the battlefields. Hopefully, one day, people not yet born will be going through a box that they find in a dusty old loft, pull out this file, and they'll read the story of Frederick Frost, sergeant, not private. And maybe they themselves will take the file and head over to the Western Front and do exactly what we did a couple of weeks ago, following his footsteps. Now, I mentioned that Fred went back to the village of Harpole and resumed his marriage with Irene, but they did have one child, and his name was Roy. And Roy was born on the 24th of February 1925, and when the Second World War came around in 1939, he was just 14 years old. But 4 years later, just before his 18th birthday, he joined the Royal Army Service Corps and became a mechanic. His service took him to Burma, but tragically, in August of 1945, just as the war in the Far East was coming to an end, he died aged 20. He's buried in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission's cemetery in what's now called Bangladesh. On his headstone, Fred and Irene chose these words: "He lives enshrined in our hearts, beloved and never forgotten, Mam and Dad." A newspaper article tells us that back home in Harpole, there was a memorial service for Lance Corporal Roy Frost, the only child of Mr. and Mrs. F.J. Frost, who died in an Indian military hospital from an infantile paralysis contracted on the Burma front. Lance Corporal Frost was a member of the church choir, and on occasions, since he was 12, played the organ at the services. He was a keen sportsman and was employed by Padmore and Barnes Limited at the Moccasin Works in Northampton. It's another boot and shoe factory. He served as an ARP messenger before joining the Harpole Home Guard. He'd served for 2 years and 5 months and went to Burma in February of 1945. He managed to get his service records from the Ministry of Defence, and his casualty report tells us that he became ill in June of 1945, and for a few weeks his condition remained unchanged until it deteriorated on the 8th of August of 1945. A couple of days later, pneumonia had set in and he had some abscesses on his lung, and sadly that led to his demise. So poor old Fred and Irene back home, there's no way that they ever got to see his grave out there in far off Bangladesh. Fred had been through everything he'd been through in the First War. No doubt young Roy wanted to follow in his father's footsteps. He didn't die in battle, he died of disease, as so many soldiers have done down the ages. So to end the podcast this week, I wanted to talk to Tim Smith. It's his great uncle whose footsteps we've been following. It's now been a couple of weeks since we returned home, and I thought it'd be interesting to get Tim's thoughts on what he experienced during our tour. So we couldn't actually meet up, so I spoke to Tim on the phone, which is why the sound recording isn't great. And I started off by asking him what Fred had done when he returned home from the war.
Went back to work and just kept, you know, as most villagers did, picked up his shoemaking career and did that till he retired.
And he was married to Irene, wasn't he, for many years?
Yeah, and that remained so, and he stayed in Harpole, probably the next street over from where he was born.
Yeah.
And stayed there till his death, really. So it was that event that was the First World War was pretty much the big thing that happened. And after that, he lived a very calm life. Yeah, that's what started this off.
Yeah.
They had Roy. They had this one son. That's it. They had Roy.
Yeah.
And he was the only son. And, I tell you, he did. So there is more to tell.
Go on.
Because he became a sergeant in the Home Guard in the Second World War. And he was the right-hand man to the village colonel.
Yeah.
So he pretty much helped run the Home Guard.
Yeah, in Harpole, in the village.
Yeah,
in Harpole. Right.
Yeah.
So we know that he got a gunshot wound to his right hand, and you knew him, didn't you? You knew him personally. Yeah. Did he ever talk about it, and was the wound ever visible?
No, he nobody in the family other than me knew, because you'd discovered it. Yeah. No one knew about that.
Right.
So he didn't talk about it, and it didn't impair him in any way.
No.
So he was able, he made a full recovery and was able to go back to his work in life.
Yeah, yeah. And they just had that one son, you said, who was Roy. And Roy went off and joined the army and went out to India and unfortunately died of disease there, didn't he? And that's, as you say, that's what started this story off, wasn't it?
At 19, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much it for Roy, yeah. And I think, I think that played a big sort of part in their lives that they don't think they ever really got over that.
Mm. Because you said he didn't drink, didn't you? Did you say he was...
Yeah, so he didn't drink. He was a God-fearing man.
Yeah.
So very, lived by very strict sort of rules. He was a stickler for being teetotal and very careful with his money.
Yeah.
but not particularly outspoken, though. You know, quite you know, he didn't suffer fools, but he was quite a relatively quiet man from what I remember in his older age.
Yeah, yeah. And what did the trip mean to you then, following in his footsteps?
I'm still digesting it, to be honest. there's not a day since I got back where I don't mull over the moments and where we stood and what we saw and how we felt. And so I revisit it all the time, really.
Wow.
And it was a real luxury to immerse myself in something. So with you having such knowledge, that is a luxury that I don't think will ever be repeated. To be able to travel that journey and to sort of almost live Fred's life as much as we could, and to understand what he'd been through, it brought the man back alive, really. And
yeah.
I'm looking forward to bringing him alive for his other relatives.
Yes.
My mum's busy reading through now your folder, and my dad started reading it as soon as I sent it.
Yeah.
So and he's, you know, he's relating all the things, so it's bringing Fred right back in to the current family, bringing him back.
That's
back
great.
In making him current, which really makes it all worth it to me.
Yeah, and hopefully in decades to come, when, like we said before, when we're all gone, someone's going to pick up that folder, and maybe, you know, someone in your family who's not yet bored is going to follow in his footsteps in the same way as we did. That would be fantastic.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't it?
That would be amazing to think that his name will live on and what he's been through, and his son as well. So that hopefully will all come to fore.
Oh, right. Oh, that's perfect, mate, because that just caps off the podcast anyway. And it was, it was an honour for me, really, to be able to take you on this journey over to the battlefield and stand in places like on that Moylanes Ridge on the 4th of March 1917, places that I've never been to before.
Because it's funny, my dad said to me, he said, it looks really flat where the battles took place. I said, it does, Dad, until you're standing on those ridges or in those dips, and then you appreciate the lie of the land, and it's not flat at all, is it?
No. You know, some battlefields are. If you go down to the Loos battlefield, which we didn't go to because he wasn't there, that is as flat as a pancake and therefore presents different challenges to the people that were there, you know, attacking across flat land. But all of the places that we went to were undulated in different ways, weren't they? Some more than others across the three battlefields.
Only when you think of it from the point of fighting a war and who's got the advantage do those undulations become really important.
Mm, yeah. Well, it was a blighty wound that he got, and it meant that he could return home and, not tell his story, but we've told his story for him, haven't we?
Absolutely.
Indeed. Brilliant.
It was such an interesting in-depth, for me, I know you do it often, but for me it was really a real joy in a strange way, but
yeah.
to be able to just walk those steps, it made a huge difference to me.
I've done so many of these tours where it ends at a memorial to the missing, or ends at a graveside, a headstone in a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery, but this one didn't. So it was so good to be able to tell the story that he got a wound and came back and lived a full life. I think that's we've got a happy ending, haven't we?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's good sometimes to have that.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Right, thank you for that, Tim.
Thanks, Terry. Right.
I wondered how to end the podcast. We normally play The Last Post. And of course, I don't think that's appropriate because Fred came home. And I wondered what would be appropriate. And then I remembered I'd got this short recording of a World War I veteran called Jack Rogers singing that famous old song, It's a Long Way to Tipperary. And in my mind's eye, I could see Fred marching along, leading his men when he was a sergeant, maybe thinking of Irene back home, and singing along just as they did something like this.
All together now, it's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly. Farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.
It's a long way.